Belgic Confession 25, the abolishing of the ceremonial law. We believe that the ceremonies and figures of the law ceased at the coming of Christ, and that all the shadows are accomplished, so that the use of them must be abolished amongst Christians. Yet the truth and substance of them remain with us in Jesus Christ, in whom they have their completion. In the meantime, we still use the testimonies taken out of the law and the prophets to confirm us in the doctrine of the gospel and to regulate our life in all honesty to the glory of God according to his will. Our new subject in our Belgic confession classes is the ceremonial law. And for a brief definition, we'll say more about it later tonight and in subsequent classes. A brief definition, the ceremonial law refers to those ceremonies or outward rites which God commanded Israel to perform and observe under the Old Covenant. The ceremonies or outward rites which God commanded Israel to perform and observe under the Old Covenant. Can you give me five examples of ceremonies?
Animal sacrifice.
Circumcision.
Sorry, Julia.
Passover.
There's three.
Tabernacle.
The Feast of Tabernacles. And if you took away the S, you'd have another one. The Tabernacle. Yeah. We've reached five. Now, I would guess that Belgic Confession Article 25, the abolishing of the ceremonial law, was an unexpected article. That is, you didn't see it coming. Unless, of course, you looked ahead and literally did see it coming. But what I mean is, you didn't see it coming logically and theologically. It seems a little bit out of kilter with the other articles. It appears, perhaps, because I'm only guessing here, unnatural to you, that you may not even have put this in a confession and you've been writing it, and if you had put it in a confession, you wouldn't have put it here. I see one or two nods there. Thanks, Mario. I like to know I'm along the right lines. Yet, Belgic Confession 25 is linked to the preceding articles. Articles 22, 23, and 25 deal with the Ordo Salutis, which means, Chris?
The Order of Salvation.
The Order of Salvation. And you could count, and Chris, we've been looking at it Monday nights. It deals, therefore, these three articles with the application of Christ's redemption to us. It's a soteriology, the doctrine of salvation. So that Article 22, faith. Article 23, justification, because we're justified by faith. Article 24, sanctification, because we're justified, and then comes the godly life of sanctification. So faith, justification, sanctification, the Ordo Salutis, the order of salvation. Now you could bring in other elements, you could fill that out, but that's the basic idea. Then we come to Article 25. And the connection between 24, sanctification, and 25 is this. It speaks of the role of God's law, or at least one aspect of God's law, the ceremonial law, in the Christian's life of sanctification. So sanctification, Article 24, then an aspect of the law in Article 25. So we're dealing here with the role of the law in the life of sanctification. And especially, what part of Belgic Confession 25 proves this, that there's a role of the law, and even the ceremonial law, in the Christian life of holiness? The part I was looking for was especially that the substance of the law, as regards guidelines and imperatives for us, even in the ceremonial law, regulates, the last sentence, the last line or so, they regulate our life in all honesty to the glory of God according to his will. So here's the idea. The role of the ceremonial law in sanctification for the Christian is not that we have to observe these ceremonial laws as to their outward rites. The article says the use of them must be abolished among Christians. So we don't have to do circumcision or build a tabernacle in our back garden or take our son, our oldest son, and consecrate him as the family priest or something like that. But positively, the ceremonial law, rightly understood, as far as the testimonies drawn from them, not only points us to Christ, but also regulates our life in all honesty to the glory of God according to His will. I would also say that Belgic Confession 25 is probably the most unfamiliar article on truth in the Belgic Confession. Probably the most unfamiliar article on truth. Especially unfamiliar article in the Belgic Confession. This whole issue of the ceremonial law, is it in the Canons of Dort?
No.
Is it in the Heidelberg Catechism?
Yes,
it is, in a minor way. Let's turn to Heidelberg Catechism, question and answer 19. Heidelberg Catechism, question and answer 19. And this is also the Lord's part of the Lord's Day that we're going to treat this Sunday, Lord willing. Heidelberg Catechism, question and answer 19. Whence knowest thou this about Jesus Christ our Saviour? Answer, from the Holy Gospel, which God himself first revealed in paradise, opening chapters of Genesis, and afterwards published by the patriarchs and prophets, and third, represented by the sacrifices and other ceremonies of the law, our subject in these classes, and fourth and lastly, has fulfilled it in his only begotten Son. So it's not in the Canons of Dort, it's not in the Heidelberg Catechism in a fully fleshed out way, although there is a bit there in question and answer 19, and it hasn't been in the Belgic Confession until now, with Belgic Confession 25. And this is, therefore, our fullest confessional statement on the ceremonial law. And that means, since this is the place for it amongst all our confessional literature, that we have to do justice to it. Because if we don't deal with it now, we won't really be dealing with it in a systematic way anywhere else. So that means we're going to have at least a few articles on it. We're not going to have 20, though, like the last article. What about the ceremonial law in connection with the preaching and teaching in the CPRC that I've been giving for almost 15 years? Have you heard from me much about the ceremonial laws? Well, it does come up in catechism classes. Any idea where in catechism classes? Old Testament history, dealing with Israel in the wilderness. There's bits there about the ceremonial law and especially the tabernacle. But looking round, none of you were there. There's one series, and it's on our website too, one series that has dealt most with the ceremonial law in all the time I've been here. Any ideas? Many of you weren't here when they were preached. Probably about half of you weren't here when they were preached. One series. The answer is Christ's Melchizedekian priesthood in Hebrews chapter 7. It was actually mentioned in a couple of Belgic confessions or so before, or a few before. And of course there have been general references in the preaching to the sacrifices, they crop up in the Bible, and to the tabernacle. There was a series also on the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant, though it was more history than ceremonial law, but it was there. Then there were some sermons that dealt with Nazarites. There were a couple of sermons on the Nazarites in Numbers chapter 6. And recently there was a sermon in this church that dealt with the idea of the Nazarite.
Samson.
Samson. Reverend McGeown's been preaching on Samson. And I've touched upon Nazarite in another series of sermons in connection with a different historical personage. John the Baptist. Yeah. So this is the great place in the confessions that deals with the ceremonial, Belgian Confession 25. We haven't had occasion in the preaching and teaching or any other Bible classes to deal with it, so you know, this is the time when we get into it. And now, after those introductory remarks, I want to underscore for you the importance of Belgic Confession 25 and these truths, because I would guess that this article isn't perhaps something that you would immediately warm to. You might have thought, having read this beforehand, you know, I'm not sure we're going to get much out of this. It's not my favorite. I looked forward to treatments of that one or that one, but Trevor, you're nodding. Yeah. If, for instance, you were to look at the 25 articles and think to yourself, you know, there's one here, if I had to be away on holiday, and if I had to miss, you might have been tempted to pick Belgic Confession 25. So let me persuade you that that would have been a rash decision, or at least it would have required a bit more thought. First of all, some biblical books. In the Old Testament, you have 1 in 39 chance here, thinking mathematically. What Old Testament book especially deals with the ceremonial law? Now, many of them touch upon, but if you had to pick one book on the ceremonial law in the Old Testament, what would it be?
Leviticus.
You're right. In the New Testament, we're only allowed one book. What would that book be?
Hebrews.
Very good. So there's two key books, Leviticus and Hebrews. If you don't understand the truth of the ceremonial law, you're going to find those two books particularly heavy going. Let's move to some issues that are very closely, or closely anyway, related to the ceremonial law. First of all, issues pertaining to Scripture. You need to understand the ceremonial law and its abolition in your own reading of God's Word, because it keeps cropping up. So when you're reading the Bible, this is a very important subject you're going to come up with. And if you want to get this straight, that'll help you understand the Scriptures. The exegesis of the Bible, the interpretation of the Bible, this is a key hermeneutical principle. There are these ceremonial laws and they have been abolished. So how do you interpret the Bible? Also, there's the subject of typology. Can anyone explain for us what typology is?
Sure.
Yes. Typology, that longer word comes from a shorter word, types. Types. The typology that such and such a person or place or thing is typical of or points towards or foreshadows a reality. Adam is a type of Christ who is to come. That's part of typology. It isn't actually part of the ceremonial law typology, but much of typology is ceremonial law typology. Jonah spending 3 days and three nights in the belly of the whale, that's typology, because that pictures Christ's burial and resurrection, but it's not Old Testament ceremonial law typology. The tabernacle is that. But most typology, or at least a huge proportion of it, is in the ceremonial law. Then, of course, we have singing the Psalms. How does Belgic Confession 25 help you in singing the Psalms? I'll give you a clue. It has nothing to do with hitting the high notes or the low notes. So how does it help you there?
The Psalms are typical and foreshadow the coming of Christ.
The Psalms contain typological material, ceremonial law material, and that's part of the reason why Christians don't sing them. Because they don't understand the book of Hebrews, which interprets, and there's other parts of the New Testament, which interprets the ceremonial law. They haven't got Belgic Confession 25 straight. And so they say, well, I couldn't see ourselves as sacrifices and purge me with hyssop, but I don't know what they're talking about. How could you sing that? Give me Isaac Watts every day of the week. I know what he's on about. So that's important. That's important even for singing the Psalms. So those are some scriptural issues. Let's move to some other issues that show the importance of Belgic Confession 25 to the realm of eschatology. Now, I don't mean eschatology merely in the sense of the last days, but eschatology in the broad sense, the whole issue of time and development of the truth. The history of redemption, right? You could split it up into three periods. Before the law, including the ceremonial law, our particular interest now, that would be, let's say, the book of Genesis and Job, I reckon, before the law. During the law, which would be from Moses to John the Baptist and the life of Christ, and then after the law, from the Pentecost onwards. So there's the history of redemption, and the ceremonial law has a part in that. Then you could say this ceremonial law in the field of eschatology, the time aspect of history of redemption, also includes the relationship between the Old Testament and the New Testament eras. If someone asked you to explain the difference between the Mosaic Covenant, the Old Covenant era, and the New Covenant era, you could not explain that properly. You could say various things about it that are true, but you couldn't explain it properly and fully without dealing with the ceremonial law. Okay? And then, in this field of eschatology, now we come to eschatology proper, the end times. Belgic Confession 25, how does that relate to eschatology, eschatological views? End time views.
I'm talking about a particular view
in the end times, a particular system.
Dispensationalists who believe
that this will be reenacted again. Yes. The dispensationalists and the premillennialists want to bring back the ceremonial law. Have to bring back the ceremonial law in their literal millennium, because they interpret the prophets literalistically, though not always literalistically, only when it suits them, because there are clashes if you take them literalistically and absurdities when you take it literalistically. But if you take these prophecies literalistically and believe in a literal millennium, then these ceremonial laws come back with a vengeance in the millennium. You all see that? Yeah. The latter chapters of Ezekiel, for instance. So, this subject, the ceremonial law, is important for the Bible, Bible reading, Bible singing, and so on, and the Psalms, important for eschatology. Now, a third area, it's important for the right understanding of God's law. And we'll preach this from different spheres. It's important for the individual Christian, as we said earlier, with regard to his sanctification. So he understands the role of the ceremonial law in his sanctification. If you don't get the ceremonial law straight, you could go wrong in the area of the church and ecclesiology. How so? How could you go wrong in the area of the church with a wrong view of the ceremonial law?
The circumcision area?
Aye. You could want to bring that one in. You could.
Yeah.
Any other ways? And there are some who have to, in the church. Yeah, Paul?
Because of the distinction that's seen between the church and Israel?
Yes. What I was especially thinking of is if you don't understand this ceremonial law and it's being abrogated with regard to the church, and maybe it should have been, the question would have been more helpful if it said instituted church, then you're going to be wanting to be bringing in things in the ceremonial law or things similar in the ceremonial law into your worship service. We'll say more about that later. Because the ceremonial law especially has to deal with the public worship of God. And there are some who want to, they're hankering after these things and bringing it in to their services. So God's law with regard to the individual Christian, especially now we're thinking of the ceremonial law, has a role in sanctification. That's, we said earlier, for Belgian Confession 25, you need to get it straight in your view of the church and the church's worship. What about the state? The role of God's law in the state? How can you go wrong here? The role of God's law in the state. And we're not so much now thinking of the ceremonial law, but the civil law. What movement particularly goes wrong here?
Theonomists.
Theonomy. Yes, the theonomists. The word theonomy consists of two parts, theo and nomi. And theo, it means pertaining to
God,
the Greek word theos, like theology. And this word,
law.
It's the word nomos, antinomianism. That N-O-M means law in Greek, and that means God's law. Theonomy means God's law. God's law as it pertains to the civil government, and particularly God's law, that's what they're standing for. The Old Testament civil laws that deal centrally with crime and punishment need to be brought in and enacted by civil governments today. So there's theonomy, and it often comes along with reconstructionism. Now, let's take this word apart. Construct means to build. If you reconstruct something, you build it again. And the idea is that theonomy is the theory. That is, the civil governments should, and because they're postmillennialists, they believe the civil governments should and will take the civil laws of the Old Testament and use them as the blueprints for civil society. So that's theonomy, is the theory, what they should do. And reconstructionism emphasizes the activity. We're going to reconstruct the civil governments. We're going to reconstruct the worlds of art and science and industry so that God's law, especially in the Mosaic law, gives definite laws, and if not definite laws, at the very least strong guidelines for every sphere of life. It sounds a bit like Sharia. I'm not putting God's law for the Jews along the same lines as the foolishness that Muhammad and his successors dreamt up. But, you know, the idea that you have a law for everything, or almost everything, and that this is what God wills on earth in this time. So, the importance of Belgic Confession 25, we've looked at under three heads, as far as the Bible goes, as far as eschatology goes in the broad sense, and as far as the law, the role of God's law, the individual Christian
the
church and the state.
Some of these laws, would they not, the Christian government that would command abortion, the question marks over adultery and what's allowed, and homosexuality? I mean, there's definitely going to be some.
Oh, aye.
There's definitely going to be something done here. You couldn't sit and tolerate some of the things that are tolerated now.
Oh, you're dead right.
Some of these things aren't going to come.
You're dead right. If Christians were in government and we had Christian politicians with power to enact godly legislation, they would most definitely repeal a whole slew of laws some of you mentioned, and they would actually go to the Pentateuch and derive principles from it. You see, the theonomist position is, at least the straightforward theonomist position, there may be some who take weaker forms, is that if the law, for instance, says that for such and such a crime, the punishment is stoning, then you're bound by God to stone the person to death. Right? So the actual punishment has to be the form that's prescribed. It takes no allowance for the different types of societies, the place in history. And the Orthodox Christian position is, and this is especially Westminster Confession 19, 4 and 5, it's the general equity of the law. Now, Christians may differ as to, you know, what principle you take here from this. There could be some discussion and so forth. But the theonomist position is that all the crimes and all the punishments have to be exactly what God says there. Unless, of course, there's some other ceremonial thing drawn into it, and then maybe they can backtrack a little bit. But we'll say more about that in due time. And when we critique theonomy and reconstructionism, we're not saying, you know, that everything they say is wrong. Nor are we saying we just think that the laws that our civil governments in the Western world have are just wonderful. There's room in between those two things. Now, let's talk about the errors and the names given for the errors in this area. What do you call the movement or the error or the people who bring in too much of the ceremonial law, or bring it in literally, or bring in too much even of the civil law. What do you call those people, and what do you call that error? There's a word for it, a word been used throughout church history. What's the word for those who retain too much of the ceremonial law, or even the civil law?
Legalists.
Legalists, yep, you could well call them legalists, yep. That's sort of the number two word.
Right.
Yep.
Judaizers.
Those who bring in these ceremonial laws and even civil laws are Judaizers because they're bringing in the Jewish laws of the Old Testament. See, someone could be a legalist, a sort of a New Testament legalist, but a Judaizer brings in these Jewish ceremonial and civil laws. Along the same line, what do you call the eschatological error, an error regarding the end times? There's Judaizers who Judaize, but there's an eschatological error. Along the same lines of Judaizing,
you've heard the phrase before, especially those who've been reading the second Helvetic
Jewish dreamers.
Jewish dreams and Jewish dreamers. And the idea is that those who hold these Jewish dreams or Jewish dreamers, Second Helvetic Confession, Article 12 mentions those, they're looking for a golden future age. And in the premillennial form, this future golden age involves Jewish ceremonial law. And in the postmillennial postmillennial reconstructionist thing, they're going in their golden age to bring in the Jewish civil law. So they are holding to Jewish dreams because they're going to Judaize in the future golden age. So when we're called by the dispensationalists replacement theologians, so we get called replacement theologians, and we say, no, you are Judaizing, because you're looking for Jewish dreams of a golden age for the Jews.
A massive support for that mistake.
Massive.
Huge.
Yep.
Huge.
Mm-hmm.
The Jews mad over there.
Some of them are. Some of them are.
Yep. Fundamental churches are.
Yes. Yep. And by the way, when we criticize this, Jews, Greeks, Japanese, all nations are equal before God, and there's even a special part as far as the worldly nation and the Christians to pray for the Jews to save them. So I don't want my negatives to make anybody think, you know, you're really holy and very reformed. If you dislike the Jews or something, that's not the point. But these Judaizing errors need to be opposed. Let's move then to controversies in church history that involve the ceremonial law. In the New Testament age, so we're thinking here in the pages of the New Testament scriptures, there were those who Judaized with regard to the ceremonial law, and they erred by excess. First of all, the Jews themselves did this, and this is evident, for instance, at the trial of Jesus Christ. Matthew 26:61. Matthew 26:61. And admittedly, Christ hasn't died and the Jewish law hasn't quite been there, but you can see where they're heading. There's a trajectory here. Matthew 26:61. Two false witnesses came in and they gave a garbled account of words of Jesus. Matthew 26:61. They said, "This fellow said," referring to Christ, "I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it again in 3 days." Now, Jesus didn't actually say that. They garbled it. But you can see there that ceremonial law as regards the temple. More clearly, in the book of Acts, we see this in the trial of Stephen. Acts 6:13-14. And again, this is a false witness. They're twisting what Stephen said. They set up false witnesses which said against Stephen, Acts 6, 13, this man ceaseth not to speak blasphemous words against this holy place, the temple and Mount Zion and Jerusalem, and the law, including the ceremonial law, for we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth shall destroy this place, the temple and Mount Zion and Jerusalem, and shall change the customs which Moses delivered us, including the ceremonial law. So here are controversies involving the ceremonial law in the New Testament age between the believing church and the Jews. There are also controversies in the New Testament age with false brethren regarding the ceremonial law. There was a church council that dealt with this in the Bible. A church council which dealt with a false view of the ceremonial law.
We just read it.
It's Philip, we can count on you. Acts 15. Of course, you should have known too, because not just from your Bible knowledge, not just in the fact that I read it, but also the fact that there only is one church council in the New Testament. Acts 15. Well, the first church council dealt with people who erred regarding the ceremonial law. Acts 15. That was the occasion. Some people said you have to be circumcised, verse 1. After the manner of Moses, or you can't be saved. Salvation is by faith and circumcision. And then that council met in Jerusalem to resolve this problem, and they produced a letter. James said in verse 20 to the council, this is later formalized in a letter, we should write unto them, those converts from the Gentiles, that they abstain, one, from pollution of idols, and two, from fornication, and three, from things strangled, and from blood. We'd say a lot more about that, we probably will in days ahead. What New Testament book especially deals with the Judaizers?
Galatians.
Yeah. Hebrews is the New Testament book which deals most with the ceremonial law, but Galatians is the New Testament book that deals most with the Judaizers. So we have these Judaizing tendencies in the New Testament. Have you heard of a man in the early church called Marcion? Marcion didn't err by excess bringing in these ceremonial laws. He erred by defect. He didn't like the Old Testament, including these ceremonial Jewish laws, so he omitted from his canon all the Old Testament, 39 books gone, and much of the New Testament. He kept the Pauline books in a truncated or abbreviated form of Luke, and he didn't even keep all of Paul's canon. He dropped the pastoral epistles. But this didn't like the Judaizers. He was way to the other extreme. And if you wanted to read more about Marcion, where would you go? Contending, Professor Henko's book, Contending for the Faith. Very near the start, there's a chapter on Marcion. What about, moving forward somewhat, what about the Roman Catholic Church on the ceremonial law? It errs by excess. It looks to the ceremonial law and uses it to justify its hierarchy. See, we've got a high priest, and then we have chief priests. And then we have other priests, and this is one way in which it gets the result. There's other ways, especially, remember Dionysius the Areopagite? Yeah? He had a hierarchy among the angels, and so the hierarchy. And then you see, since the Old Testament Jews had priests, they call their officiators priests. And since the Old Testament priests were such because they offered sacrifices, then the priests of Rome must have somewhat to offer, so they have their own sacrifice. They call it the Mass. The Old Testament priests offered incense, and the Roman Church have their incense. The Greek, I think, waft more incense than them. Then there's holy oil. What's it called? The priests were in the Old Testament were anointed with oil. The holy oil in the Roman Church, chrism. And then there's holy water. See? They're Judaizing. They're taking not one for one, dead straight parallels, but they're bringing in these principles.
And if they all burn with the tabernacle on the shop as well.
Yeah, you do, especially the place where they keep the wee wafer and so forth.
What does the Jews, Before going any further, I admire the Jews for their position and stance they take against terrorists. I have a soft spot for them. I like the way it's zero tolerance.
Probably everybody in this room does.
But anyway, what did the Jews make of all this interest in them, particularly from states?
They like it.
They do. They like the dollar.
They do.
They like it, playing up to it just to get the money.
Yep, and a certain amount of international support, they like it. I mean, you'll even hear Benjamin Netanyahu making statements along those lines. We welcome Christian pilgrims coming over here, and we share a lot with you, and you're very welcome. And they don't like evangelism among them.
But what about the sacrifices and the way things were in the Old Testament? I mean, how do they see that playing out in the future? You know, these guys who are supporting them financially in a massive way, particularly people you've mentioned, they see that being reenacted after Christ's second coming. But the Jews are still looking for the Messiah, so. Well, when they hear that those things being said, what's the response? Because they want the dollar, so they.
Mm-hmm. They also like some international support because they feel a bit isolated. Yeah. But those are good questions, and we'll let them all hang, and we hope to get address them either directly or very nearly. So just good introductory remarks. Here are some Anabaptist tendencies that are along the lines: physical separation. Physical separations. Like the Jews, Israel shall dwell in safety alone physically. So you have your Anabaptist enclaves, and they're especially evident in the parts of the states, like the Hutterites and the Amish and so forth. That's an Anabaptist tendency. Some within that tradition want to bring back some of the food laws to sort of a holy diet. Some of them particularly like the idea of prayer shawls. That's another form of Judaizing. And instead of saying hello or may the Lord bless you, a common greeting is shalom. Shalom. Now, there's nothing wrong with saying shalom to somebody. It's the biblical word for peace. But sometimes you put a wee skull cap on, you have a prayer shawl, and you pray towards Jerusalem and you shalom. Look, Christ has made us free. You don't need that paraphernalia. There's nothing particularly holy about that. Then there's Messianic Judaism. That is, Jews who claim to believe in the Messiah. And then it's difficult to explain because there's so many different tenets and varieties here. But they don't really want to be in the church. They want their own separate thing. And then they want to bring in ceremonial laws and keep rabbinic traditions and so forth. Then there's the question, how much can you keep from your own tradition? Because ethnically you did come from that. Then there's some Gentiles who want to join in and want to become Messianic Jews. But that's a whole story on itself. Then there's another movement which is worth noting. The dual covenant notion. The dual covenant notion. This doesn't mean we believe particularly that there are two covenants. Hebrews mentions the old covenant, the new covenant, following Jeremiah 31. This dual covenant theology teaches that Gentiles are saved through the new covenant, through faith in Jesus Christ, but Jews are saved through the Mosaic or Abrahamic covenant, the old covenant, without believing in Jesus Christ and without joining the church. The dual covenant. God has one covenant for saving Gentiles and another covenant for saving Jews. And there are some liberal Protestants who believe this, and there are some liberal Roman Catholics believe this. And Pope John Paul II is a liberal figure on this sort of point, makes various statements that for sure sound like this, but then they can always retract. And I mean, who can make sense of the present Pope, Pope Francis? He can't make. I think he's deliberately ambiguous, but he's more so than John Paul II. But look out for this. Look out for this. And here's another one to make this really contemporary. Even the Sodomites go severely wrong in their view of the ceremonial law in order to defend their perversion. They argue against Leviticus's condemnation of sodomy. There's many other places in the Bible, direct, and of course by necessary implication, but Leviticus is condemnation of sodomy, which says that it's toeva, sodomy, man with a man, is toeva, or an abomination. Toeva is the Hebrew way of saying it. It's an abomination. And then they note that it says that eating these wrong, eating certain foods, like shellfish, that's toeva too, that's an abomination. So then they say that word toeva shouldn't be translated abomination, that is something morally repugnant, but it should be translated taboo. It's a taboo. It's not really morally wrong, but it's just something you don't do in society. It's an old-fashioned notion. Right? And that's a total misunderstanding of the ceremonial law. We could say an awful lot. And then you see they try and take away this one in Leviticus, and then they go to Romans, and they go to all the other passages in the Old and New Testament, and come up with contorted and really pathetic arguments, because they ought to be said what they are. Total rubbish. There seems a special pleading. So those are some of the importance. Let's now come to this threefold division or distinction in the moral law. Who can give it to me? The threefold distinction or division in the Mosaic law.
Civil, moral, ceremonial.
The civil law, the ceremonial law, and the moral law. The moral law isn't the Ten Commandments, but the moral law is summed in the Ten Commandments. These are natural laws, necessary laws, that God couldn't have made any other way. Although there's a ceremonial aspect to the fourth commandment. We'll say a bit more about that later. Then there's the ceremonial law, the rites and ceremonies. We've spoken about that earlier, and we'll give more examples later. And then there's the civil law with crimes and punishments, for instance, that particularly pertain to the state. And then, of course, there are some laws that are mixed, partly civil and partly moral, or with a moral bit underlying the civil. And then there are some laws that are partly civil and partly ceremonial. And it's not always easy, but it's a helpful distinction. Where would you go in our three forms of unity for confessional treatments of the moral law? The Heidelberg Catechism, Lord's Days 34 to 44. Where would you go for the ceremonial law? Belgic Confession 25. Where would you go for the nearest treatment thing to a treatment of the civil law? Or where would you, in a discussion of what article, would you bring in most the civil law? You could do, but I'm thinking there's a better one. Belgic Confession 36. Belgic Confession 36 deals with the magistrates. Yeah. And it's worth mentioning here that this distinction of moral, civil, and ceremonial laws is taught, for instance, in other creeds as such, because the Belgic Confession, there are three forms of unity, don't say we distinguish the law into three sorts. They don't say that in so many words. Here's Westminster Confession of Faith 19, Articles 3 and 4. Besides this law, commonly called moral, the moral law, God was pleased to give to the people of Israel as a church underage ceremonial laws containing several typical ordinances, partly of worship, prefiguring Christ, his graces, actions, sufferings, and benefits, and partly holding forth diverse instructions of moral duties, all which ceremonial laws are now abrogated under the New Testament. To them also, as a body politic, he gave sundry judicial laws, or civil laws, judicial laws, civil laws, same thing, which expired together with that, with the state of that people, not obliging any further now, further than the general equity thereof may require. Coming back to Colin's remark. Here's the 39 articles of the Church of England. Article 7 of the 39 articles is entitled of the Old Testament. The Old Testament is not contrary to the New, for both in the Old and New Testament, everlasting life is offered to mankind by Christ, who is the only mediator between God and man, being both God and man. Wherefore, there are not to be heard which feign that the old fathers did look only for transitory promises. That was the position of the Anabaptists. Although the law given from God by Moses as touching ceremonies and rites, ceremonial law, does not bind Christian men, nor the civil precepts thereof, civil law, ought of necessity to be received in any commonwealth, yet notwithstanding, no Christian man whatsoever is free from the obedience of the commandments which are called moral. So the threefold divisions in the 39 Articles of 1563. And Aquinas used this threefold division, Turretin, standard fare in the Reformed faith, and even some Jews talk about the civil, ceremonial, and moral law. Now there's opposition, especially from one group of people, to this threefold distinction in the law. If you think about it, they've been mentioned already, you'll get the answer, but it's not an easy question. The Theonomists. They don't like this threefold distinction because they want to keep the civil law. And so they want to merge the civil law. They don't want the ceremonial law. They want to merge the civil law and the moral law and make the civil law basically moral law. And that it's immoral to drop, omit, or modify the civil law. In the remaining time, I want to spell out a lot of participation here. I want to spell out some of the ceremonial laws. First of all, ceremonial laws pertaining to places. Places. The cities of refuge. The cities of refuge, yes. You could count the cities of refuge in there. Well, there's an interesting one. That's partly civil, though, too. But there's a ceremonial aspect to it. For instance, the high priest has to die before you can leave. Okay, so places.
You're talking about like Jerusalem?
Jerusalem. That's a ceremonial place. Jerusalem. The temple. And before that, the tabernacle. And then you could even talk about the divisions within the tabernacle. The holy place. The most holy place. The court. Yeah. Zion. Even the land of Canaan. That was a holy land. And what even about the 12... The division of those cities to Jews, to the priests, and to some cities to the priests, and some to the Levites, and then some territory to the 12 tribes, Gad here and Reuben there and so forth. What about the ceremonial law as pertains to people? People. The high priests, with all their clothes too. Yeah. The high priests, yeah. The priests, the Levites, the Nazarites, you could even say the Israelites, who were circumcised and put into that office. What about holy, we've looked at holy places and people, what about holy things? Things in the ceremonial law. I'll give you the altar. The candlestick. Of course, the altar of incense and the altar of sacrifice, the candlestick.
The
labors for outside. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Ark of the Covenant.
The curtain.
The curtain in the tabernacle. Yeah. It's symbolic too. Yeah. The Urim and the Thummim. What about some actions or activities that were ceremonial?
Sacrifices.
Sacrificing.
The washing, the way you had to wash.
Yep, the purifying activities with water.
Wafting incense.
The wafting of incense. That went up off the altar of incense. Anointing somebody. Yep. So you begin to see this ceremonial law is beginning to grow.
It's difficult to live during that time. But
that's exactly what the New Testament talks about, the burden. Mm-hmm. The heavy burden. Yeah. And what about some of the times? So there's ceremonial places, ceremonial people, ceremonial things, ceremonial actions, ceremonial times.
There was the Jubilee.
The Jubilee. Okay, we're starting with the big times. On the 50th year, slaves were released. Debts were cancelled. Property restored. Okay, so we're going with the years. What happened every 7 years?
Fallow.
The fallow. Very good. Very good, yeah. Yeah, then there were other things that happened. So some things happened every 50 years, and we're going downhill. I mean, shorter period of time. Some say every 7 years. Some things that happened every year, such as
Feast of Booths.
The Feast of which?
Booths.
The Feast of Booths or Tabernacles.
Passover.
Pentecost.
Day of Atonement. Then there were some things which happened monthly, a monthly ceremonial time. The new moon. Then there were other things that happened weekly.
The Sabbath.
And then there were some things that happened daily. Yes, there was the morning sacrifice and the evening sacrifice. Now, that's many of the sacred ceremonial places, people, things, actions, times. Now, let's say Leviticus. Leviticus is practically ceremonial law from cover to cover, right? Then you go back to Exodus, some of that ceremonial. Numbers, the ceremonial material in there. Deuteronomy. So that's the Pentateuch. Foundational for the Old Testament. And then you go to Joshua, Judges, Ruth, the ceremonial law things in all of those. 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, in all of them. Ezra, yes. Nehemiah, yes. Esther, not so sure about Esther. Aye. And then we come to the poetic books. Job. No, he's outside Israel, probably dated in the days of Genesis. The Proverbs, maybe bits and pieces in there. The Psalms, lots of it. Song of Solomon,
No.
Ecclesiastes, there's a little bit about there, keep your footprints when you go into the house of God, but not much. Then the four major prophets, yes. Even Daniel, it talks about some of the things taken away from the temple in the very opening verses. The 12 minor prophets, maybe not all of them, Jonah, for instance. But even then, where did Jonah pray towards?
Jerusalem.
How he knew the way when he was in the belly of the big fish underneath, but he was still praying towards Jerusalem, the Jerusalem which is above at the very least. And then the New Testament. The New Testament books mention it a whole lot. So that's key. And finally, what about Psalm 51?
What's that?
Which we sang earlier. I mean, there's various other ceremonial law parts in the opening 13 verses. What have we got in verse 16? I take it most of us are in the Psalters. Sacrifice. Anything else in 16?
Burnt offering.
What have we got in verse 18? Ceremonial places. Zion, Jerusalem. What about verse 19?
Offerings.
Righteous offerings, burnt offerings, whole burnt offerings, calves,
and the altar.
They're sacrificial animals. You can't miss them. You can't miss them. And so when we're looking at Delgy Confession 25 for the next few weeks, Lord willing, keep a lookout for these things and see how you're to understand them.